Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Trinity, a novel by Tom DeLong and A.J. Hartley. Narrated by Kyle Snyder. Prologue. It's a tricky thing, memory. Some things it locks in tight like a bug in amber, perfectly preserved so you can take them out years, even decades later, and find them just as they were. Perfect in every detail. This kind of memory is rare. Precious. Others get changed, expanded with things that never happened. Details borrowed from other events, other times, get tacked on till the memories themselves are only partly true, and it's not clear which parts those are. And, of course, other parts get dropped entirely. Like stones in the ocean that sink without a trace, vanishing into the dark. It's said that you can train your memory to hold on to the things you want and discard the rest. And I've also heard that all your memories are really still there, fully intact, but over time we lose the maps and keys that would find them and open them up. I guess that could be true. I don't know. What I do know is that it's not always good to remember. That you're better moving on, shedding the past like snakeskin and never looking back. But sometimes you don't get that lucky. Sometimes you get branded by a memory, your past burned hard and indelibly into your heart, your soul, no matter how much you want it to be otherwise. I'm old now, but I carry these things with me still. For better and worse. And it's like my bones have grown around them, so that I can no longer tell where I end and they begin. This is a story about memory. The things you hold on to, and the things you'd rather drop into that ocean darkness, are the things that make you who you are, whether you want them to or not. And it begins before most of you were born. When it all really began is, I guess, debatable. But I'm going to start on a warm March morning in 1962, because that was when it started for me. I've thought about it all a lot over the years, a hell of a lot. And though memory has, no doubt, played some of its usual tricks on me, I remember most of it like it was yesterday. Some of it, the parts that happened to other people, I've had to piece together from what I learned after it was all over. But I think I have it pretty much. Pretty much. I won't tell the story as if it was all about me, though. I don't want to do all that suddenly I knew Wonder Years shit. In fact, I won't even put myself in the story. Not directly. I'll just be one of the characters. You'll probably figure out which one. But that doesn't matter so much. Because even though I'm telling you what I saw, it's not about me. It was never about me. It's so much bigger than that. Trinity, Nevada, 1962. Chapter 1. Van Lopez was having the dream again. He wouldn't remember it. But it would eventually wake him and hold on to the edges of his consciousness for a few minutes afterwards, tugging at him like a dog that wanted feeding. He was riding a horse through the desert. Or rather, he was sitting on the horse while someone else controlled it. Someone much larger than he was. There was a curious scent in the air which made him inexplicably anxious, and the sky was strange. In the valley, something was hot and smoking. Something as strange as the sky from which it had come. We shouldn't be here. Van came out of sleep with a start, heart hammering and breathing ragged, his mind filled with a kaleidoscope of light and sound that meant nothing to him, but managed to raise the hairs on the back of his neck, sure as if he'd gotten a shock from the ragged, cloth-wrapped cable on the lamp beside his bed. He sat up, staring around his bedroom as if he might see something that would make sense of it all. But it did what it always did. The familiarity of the place, the shaded window, the heap of yesterday's clothes, the record player with the uneven stack of singles, all served to remind him of what was real and push the dream away till he could forget it. Or very nearly. He checked the luminous dial on the alarm clock. 6 a.m. He forced his brain to figure out how long he had before he needed to go to school, and whether he had time to get under the truck first and look over the transmission. A month ago, Van had managed to convince his father to replace their ancient Chevy pickup with a 6-year-old Ford F-100 that had appeared in Don Hendricks' showroom over on 2nd Street. His dad, Danny, hadn't been convinced by the F-100, which hadn't had much TLC in its short life. But Van had sworn up and down that, if they bought it, he'd do all the necessary work himself. Danny had given him his skeptical look, often a prelude to rigid denials and the kind of dour forbidding Van had learned to avoid. But, unable to stop himself, Van had babbled about what that Y-block V8 engine could do with a little attention. No, the bodywork wasn't up to much. Several light bulbs were busted, the fuel pump needed looking at, and the spark plugs would have to be replaced. But that was nothing. And when it was done, the thing would haul. He'd gone on about the truck's potential, one of Van's favorite words, staring at its battered cherry red exterior like he'd struck gold. Waxing lyrical, his brother Andy would say. When he'd remembered his dad and looked quickly back at him, half ready to step out of range and drop into an apologetic and respectful silence, Van caught a different look, rare and momentary, part amused, part sad and sort of far off, wistful. Danny, rugged and silent, had glanced away, looking down the street as if trying to track something that had just gone by, then shrugged and nodded.
"Okay," he said. "Your call."
Your call. Van had never heard anything like that from his dad before, and he knew what it meant. He was old enough to be treated as a man, just about, and was being allowed to make a man's decision. Van had stared, his chest full and his eyes wide at the enormity of the thing, and for a moment said nothing. At last he managed a nod which matched his father's.
"All right then," Van heard himself say. "Let's do it."
And then he was grinning, broad and happy. And it wasn't till they got the sputtering, lurching vehicle home that he realized that his father had given him just enough rope that he might accidentally hang himself with it. This, after all, was to be a family vehicle, the only one, other than Danny's old Norton motorcycle, for the three of them. It would have to be able to survive the rough tracks and dirt roads that skirted the fence lines his father tended for the local ranchers. That was what put food on their table. So it needed to be reliable. Southern Nye County's major resource was space. Miles and miles of it. Much of it sun-blasted and desert dry. Water and food troughs had to be kept filled, and if Danny's transport crapped out between jobs, cattle got stressed. Miss a few feeds and the steers might start dropping right there, and that was Danny's job up in smoke. Van knew he couldn't risk that happening. It wasn't as if his father had a lot of employment options. He dressed quickly and went downstairs. The radio was on as usual. Stevie Fly, KTNT DJ, local celebrity, and the unofficial voice of Trinity. He seemed to be on the air around the clock, playing records in the afternoon, reading news bulletins, and editorializing in his lounge cat drawl, then hosting late-night call-in shows, which gave a platform to every wacko in town. Bigfoot sightings, secret agents spying on the local florist, UFO fantasists. Stevie got them all. And Van's dad lapped that shit up. He'd sit there for hours unmoving, eyes on the radio speaker like it was a TV set, saying nothing, nodding occasionally. Van hated it. He knew some of the kids at school called in for a joke, talked about flying saucers or the Lake Mead monster. But they usually got called out or couldn't keep from busting up. but a lot of folks around Trinity took it all pretty seriously. Maybe it was just a way of connecting the town, and it didn't really matter. But the way people referenced all that hogwash like it was straight from the mouth of Walter Cronkite annoyed him. Van's brother Andy was still sacked out in his room, but his dad was up and at his usual spot, leaning against the frame of the kitchen window, looking out into the pre-dawn darkness, the fingers of one hand spreading the slats of the blind so he could peer out without being seen. He had a mug of coffee in the other hand, half raised to his lips, but seemingly forgotten. He wasn't moving. On the radio, Stevie Fly's molasses and cigarette ash voice was talking to some flake who had gotten all coy about whether she would sound crazy if she said what she'd obviously called in to say.
"That's okay, hon," said Stevie,
like he was her shrink or something.
"I'm here for you. Lay it on me."
The flake hesitated a second, then hesitantly began to tell her story.
"I guess it started last week. There were these lights over my house, just like sitting there. Three of them."
Van sighed, then opted for casual. "Morning," he said. His father didn't move, but his eyes flicked across the room for a moment before returning to the street outside. He said nothing. "Everything okay?" Van tried, busying himself with the cornflake packet so it wouldn't look like he was staring.
"Not sure."
Van's heart sank. "Yeah," he said, more forced casualness. "What do you see?" For a moment, his father said nothing, but his eyes narrowed, as if trying to make sense of something baffling. When he spoke, the word was barely audible, a baffled murmur delivered like he was talking to himself.
"A van," he said.
Van set the cornflakes down, took a breath, and joined his father at the window. He peered out, trying to make sense of the shadows.
"The blue Econoline?" he said.
There wasn't a vehicle on the road Van couldn't identify.
"Last year's model, inline six. Nice split grill."
He leaned in and spread the slats wider to get a better look, but his father spun around and slapped his hand away.
"What are you, stupid?"
his father demanded. Van backed away, hands raised in surrender, all casualness gone.
"It's just a van, Pops. No big deal."
His father ignored the remark and went back to gazing out. Red-faced, Van returned to his cereal, careful to make sure his annoyance didn't attract further attention. On the radio, the flake had come right out with it and said she was being visited by aliens or some damn thing. And Stevie Fly, instead of telling her to get out in the fresh air and make some friends, was making soothing, encouraging noises and calling her sister. Van glared at the radio. He was eating in resentful silence when his brother entered the room. Andy was 16, 2 years younger than Van. They were both paler skinned than their Latino father, but had his black hair and dark eyes. Andy was slim and rangy, with high cheekbones that gave him a hard, angular look. He took in the scene quickly, and his mouth went thin as a pencil line. He looked at his brother, and something unspoken passed between them, something cautious and weary, something they'd shared many times before. Van made a shrug so small it barely reached his shoulders and focused on his cereal. He looked older than his brother by more than the 2 years that actually separated them, as if he'd seen more, done more than was possible in a Nevada high school.
"Hurry up," he said. "Time for school."
It wasn't, but he wanted to be somewhere else.
"You using the truck today, Pops?"
Andy asked, his eyes still on his brother. Their father kept on looking out, then blinked as if the question had only just reached him and grunted.
"What?"
"I asked if you were using the truck today," said Andy,
as careful as someone defusing a bomb.
"Wondered if we might borrow it. Run some errands before school?"
Van shot him a questioning glance, but Andy gave his head a fractional shake to silence him. He waited for his father to speak, then licked his lips and added, What do you think? There was another loaded pause, and then, still gazing out at the blue van parked across the street, their father muttered,
Sure,
and added,
If I need to, I'll take the bike.
Then he paused, eyes still on the van.
But I ain't going nowhere.
That was said with resolution, even defiance. The two brothers exchanged another look, weary this time, resigned.
Fetch me my carbine before you go,
he added, still not looking at them. Van opened his mouth to say something, but changed his mind. Sometimes it felt like nothing would ever change. The truck started on the third attempt, its rattling cough turning to an uneven rumble punctuated with sputters and pops.
Can't believe you got him to buy this piece of junk, said Andy, lacing up his Chuck Taylors.
Give it time.
Time is what it's already had. It's old, and getting older and crappier by the minute. Give it any more time and the thing will collapse into dust and scrap.
What do you know about it? Van shot back, stung. He had already bonded with the F-100.
Whoa there, Mr. Mechanic, Andy crooned, amused. Touched a nerve? What is this, your first love? You need a girl in your life, big brother.
And you need to shut up.
Oh, yeah, said Andy, grinning. Definitely touched a nerve.
Van backed the truck out of the hard earth driveway and into the deserted street. He could feel Andy's challenging stare, but he was still thinking vaguely about his father, still standing at the window, still watching the innocuous blue van. He was getting worse. The sun was up now, but only barely, and the distant mountains were painted an improbable gold. The last of the snow lay on their crags and high reaches, as if layered on by an artist. Van frowned at them, wondering how you would capture that look with a brush without it looking like the lid of a chocolate box. He caught Andy watching him and gunned the engine, filling the dawn with animal snarl.
Where to? He said.
What?
You said you had errands.
Right, said Andy, looking away. One errand. Head northeast toward the army base. I'll direct you.
The army base was one of Trinity's open secrets. Everyone knew it was there, but no one talked about it. Trinity was that kind of place, a town which had sort of happened, individual plots spilling into each other and turning isolated individuals into a taciturn, accidental community.
Where are we going? Van pressed.
I said I'll direct you, said Andy.
Van was used to his brother's petulance and his need to be in control. But something in his manner struck him as furtive.
You want to tell me where we're going, or you want to walk? He said.
Just over onto Gamebird, corner of Sagebrush.
Andy still wasn't looking at him. Van drove along the baked dirt road, thinking. At last he said,
There's nothing there. Fields, a construction site. Where are we going?
I'll show you, okay? Jeez, Andy sighed. What's with the third degree?
He shifted on the seat, trying to get comfortable with his head against the passenger door, and closed his eyes.
It's too early for this shit, he muttered.
Your idea, said Van.
It was no more than 3 miles on largely empty roads through open country. Fields of alfalfa, cotton, and cattle pasture, all enjoying a blessed respite from the heat that would arrive like a biblical plague over the next few months. Even in March, though the days started cold, only a few degrees above freezing, it would be in the upper 60s by mid-afternoon, and would go up another 8 to 10 degrees per month through the end of July, when 100-degree temperatures were routine, and bad days could push as high as 112, 114, sometimes more. It was unforgiving country. The Paiute who had lived there before the region was colonized had only survived because of the artesian wells tapping the aquifer beneath the mountains. It was still new to Van and Andy, who had only been there 3 years, having moved from the dazzling gypsum sand flats of New Mexico when the ranch their father had worked on closed down, its cattle victims of drought and sickness. They felt like outsiders here. The little town was almost as white as the New Mexico desert they'd left behind, and were still finding their feet in the intermittently hot and cold war that was high school. People were harder to navigate than the desert, or, for that matter, engines. Van was silent as he drove, taking it all in, slowing and smiling silently as he caught the blur of a coyote loping across the road. It flashed him a look, and its eyes glowed bright and otherworldly in the Ford's headlights. Then it slunk into the scrub brush and was gone. In time, most of this land would be consumed by housing and commercial development as Las Vegas sprawled, flexing belligerently to the southeast. But in 62, this was still mostly open country, its unincorporated towns small and scattered. Trinity had only the minuscule beginnings of a telephone system since the previous year, and few of the roads were paved. Van and Andy didn't know it, but they were among the last to grow up with the view they had that morning. The wide, hard ground turned into fields by brutal labor, the clear vantage on the rugged peaks of the Spring Mountains to the east and the Nopah Mountains to the west, and all around the hard, blank grip of the Mojave Desert. It was a vast, humbling space, which, for all its ground features, was mostly sky. Even with his brother half asleep beside him, Van felt alone. He liked it, and for a moment he stopped worrying about whatever nonsense Andy was up to this time, and watched the sunrise bring the desert to vibrant life, gold and pink and turquoise. The construction site appeared almost out of nowhere, a billboard proclaiming Homes of the Future, and a chain-link fence, inside which they could just make out the shapes of graders, a crane, and other building equipment, sitting silently like sleeping mastodons. Posts had been driven into the ground at regular intervals, and small, regular lots taped out, with poured concrete foundation slabs laid over what had once been the vast wildness of the desert. If this was the future, Van didn't think much of it. His mind flashed back to the coyote, and he wondered if the animal had been driven from a den around here. Maybe he could paint that. The coyote looking out over the desert toward those gilded mountains, maybe with the ugly sprawl of tract housing filling the valley. Two on the nose? Maybe. "Pull over there," said Andy, breaking into his reverie. "And turn your lights off." "Why? What are we doing? For once, just do as I say, okay? And keep your voice down." Van frowned and turned the engine off. "I don't like—" he began. But Andy was already out and closing the door softly. "God damn it." Andy was walking softly along the fence. He tried the gate and found it latched but unlocked. "Andy!" Van hissed, clambering out of the truck. Andy spun around, forefinger on his lips and eyes wide with exasperation. He pushed the gate wide and pointed, mouthing, "Wait." Van hesitated as his brother slipped inside the perimeter, breaking into an easy run. "Like the coyote," Van thought. There was a prefabricated cabin with a light on in the window, and great, regular stacks of building materials, mostly bound with cable as if only recently unloaded. Andy vanished among them, and for a moment, Van truly was alone in the dawn silence. He marveled at the efficient ugliness of the building site, and hugged his arms around himself against the chill of the morning. He listened, but barely heard his brother before he saw him. Andy looked excited and, for all his careful stealth, could barely contain a giggle. It made him look young, as few things seem to these days.
"Roll the truck in through the gate," he said. "Quietly. Park it over there next to that sign. Then come give me a hand." "Andy, what the hell? Just do it, okay? It's for a good cause. Someone will see. Contractors don't get here till 7 or later. There's a watchman, but he'll have been stewing in Jack Daniels overnight, so don't sweat it, big brother."
And then he was gone again, scampering off like a jackrabbit. Van sputtered his frustration, but put the truck in neutral and struggled to push it slowly forward and in through the gate, taking care not to catch the already battered bodywork on the aluminum posts. Once it got rolling, he hopped in and guided the F-100 over the hard, uneven ground. Then he brought it to a gentle stop and got out, closing the door softly. Something of his brother's secretive glee had infected him, and Van felt a spike of wild joy at the idea that, in a way he didn't understand, he and his brother were going to stick it to the people who made those faceless boxes for people, where there should be only snakes and the ancient stones they had plowed under. Even as he thought it, he knew it was dumb. But then Andy was back and whispering,
"Help me with this!"
It was a girder, bright and new-looking, about 8 feet long, some kind of steel stud used for framing houses. Van stared at him.
"What? Help you how? Get it in the truck, man,"
said Andy, as if it was obvious.
"What?" Van replied. "You know what we can get for a couple of these? Come on, quick!"
"You're not serious," said Van. He watched as Andy tried to get his fingers under one end of the girder.
"Come on," said Andy. "Won't take but a minute."
"No way," said Van.
"I won't scrape up the bed," Andy said. "Promise."
Van frowned, momentarily confused, then realized his brother was talking about the varnished oak lining the back of the F-100.
"That's not,"
he began, then shook his head.
"Get in the truck. We're leaving."
But Andy was still carefully lifting one end of the girder, looking around with a shifty intensity.
"I said, get in the truck,"
he repeated, his voice lower now, cooler.
"I'm telling you,"
said Andy, pretending not to hear the shift in Van's tone.
"This is good stuff. Serious cash right here."
"And I said no,"
said Van, stiffening. Andy looked at him, gauging how far Van was prepared to go.
"Are you kidding me?"
he said.
"It's just some rich guy's metal scraps. What do you care?"
"I care that it will come back on me, on Dad," said Van. "And I'm done talking about it. Get in the damn truck."
Andy let the steel beam drop, but he came out of his crouch, fired up, lurching toward Van.
"What are you, the goddamn sheriff?"
Andy spat.
"You're taking their side?"
"What side?"
Van demanded, his voice rising.
"Don't play the—"
But he didn't get to finish the sentence. There was the clang of a metal door flung wide and a flurry of movement from the cabin.
"What the hell you think you're doing?"
bellowed a voice.
"Nice going, Lone Ranger,"
snapped Andy, as if this was Van's fault. Van hesitated, but only for a moment. On the steps of the cabin was a big, bearded man. He was cradling what looked, even at this distance, like a shotgun. Van dove for the driver's side and leaped in. Andy was still out at the back, but he roared,
"Go!"
as he shimmied into the passenger seat. Van turned the ignition key, and the engine puttered into unimpressive life. At the same moment, there was a blast of sound, flat and hollow, and the passenger side mirror tore right off. Van cursed, shrinking in place, then checked the rear view in time to catch the watchman reloading his shotgun. The F-100 rocketed backwards, sliding on the dusty ground as Van yanked the steering wheel hard, sending the truck slewing around. Then it was surging forward in great uneven bounds as the old engine fought for rhythm. Van aimed the hood at the gate and put the truck in gear as another shotgun blast slammed into its tail. Van checked the mirror again, but his brother just screamed,
"The fuck you waiting for? Go!"
Van floored it. As he sped through the gate and onto the highway, he caught sight of the watchman running for a vehicle of his own. He was giving chase.
Great, just great.
He turned to shoot Andy a menacing glare and was amazed to see his brother howling with laughter, leaning out of the window and flipping his middle fingers back toward the construction site. The V8 was still warming up, but as it did so, the uneven, sputtering flash and roll settled into a long purr, and there they were, all 170 horses straining to get loose. Most of them, anyway. There was more work to do on that engine. Still, it would take something special to catch them once they hit their stride. Van was still thinking that when he saw a yellow pickup blast out of the compound and onto the road. It clipped the gate, sending it crashing back against the chain link, but the truck didn't hesitate. It slid around in a pall of dust and exhaust fumes and came barreling after them. Van gripped the wheel and pushed the accelerator.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?